just for everyone's benefit, you know, let me just say a quick few words about you, and then, you know, you could actually just also explain a little bit more about, like, why you're so awesome. but everyone should hear at least why I think you're awesome, although I won't have a complete, you know, bio to give. So for everybody, you know, we have a very special guest today, and it's Clayton Makepeace. And Clayton is actually someone who I met, like, I guess about almost a year ago, but it's been somebody who actually I've been following for a lot longer than that. Actually, when I first got into direct response, I came across some ads that Clayton had written for Magalogs that had just completely blown me away. And I didn't know at the time they were written by Clayton, but as I was finding great Magalogs and putting them aside, a lot of them happened to have been written by Clayton. And when I found out that some of them had been written by Clayton, I actually started following Clayton quite closely and just trying to stay on top of everything that he had written, because he took a different approach to copywriting, and it's actually an approach that I'm a big fan of, and actually I'm a big fan of it because I think it actually works about 100 times better than traditional copywriting, in the sense of he uses a lot more emotionally driven copywriting. And so his headlines might not scream like a benefit in it, but nonetheless, it screams like some a great emotion, and because of that, it actually works on someone like me, who is more easily pulled into copy when it's emotionally driven. So I've been a huge fan of Clayton's for a long time, and then I got the chance to actually talk to Clayton about a year ago, and when I did, I happened to have been working on the Attention Age Doctrine too, I sent him a copy of what I was working on, and he actually helped me tremendously get it in order, because I had no idea how I was going to say certain things up front and how to make sense of, like, all this research that I had put together in this document. And I think it all can be kind of summed up with how good Clayton is, and how much he helped me by what was said on, and it's on the blog, for the download of the Attention Age Doctrine too. At least two people, and I think there were actually more, but I remember two specifically that said, I knew everything that you said in your report, yet I still couldn't put it down. And I think that shows you just how good Clayton is, that the little tweaks and the changes that he made in the doctrine made it so that people read it all the way through, even when they knew what was in there. And so that goes to just show what a master copywriter Clayton is, and Clayton has become like high on the Rolodex as like the go-to guy for me when I have a question about marketing in general and copywriting specifically. So with that said, but Clayton has a lot of other incredible accomplishments. I think the one that like stands out to me is you gave birth basically to the whole health newsletter field. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so now it's like a billion-dollar business, and here's the guy that basically got it all started and wrote the Magalogs and wrote the sales pieces that basically gave birth to this whole industry. But that's kind of a feather in his cap, something that's a lot bigger than just helping me with the doctrine. but nonetheless, I'm sure there was a lot more that you've done, Clayton, and maybe you could give people like just a quick bio on you so that they really understand the scope, the depth, and the skill that you bring to the table.
Sure. Well, thanks for that introduction, Rich. I'll keep it short. I've been doing it 37 years. I've been writing copy for direct response promotions for 37 years now. And I've done television direct mail and now almost exclusively internet marketing. We sat down the other day and tallied up the total sales that we could attribute to campaigns that I've done over the years, and it came to just short of $1.5 billion.
Wow.
Which blew my mind. And we have, the clients we work with, we're doing probably $100 million average per year in sales, so that number is continuing to mount. Just a couple of weeks ago, we put 20,000 investors on a conference call, an online event actually, and sold $2.5 million worth of product in the following 7 days. I guess that kind of sums it up. That's where we're at. Where I'm still a working copywriter. I'm not just teaching, but I do teach through my site, MakePeaceTotalPackage.com. And we have thousands of marketers in 67 countries who come to our blog every day to read articles on how to sharpen their marketing.
And it's not only actually marketers, but it's also a lot of small business owners, copywriters, et cetera, that follow your work, isn't it?
That's right. We had a hilarious entry yesterday. This guy from Malaysia writes in and says he just wanted to warn everybody that if you can't handle success, don't read Clayton, because, you know, he's been reading me for a couple of years now. And so he's over there in Malaysia with a home on a mountain overlooking the South China Sea. He's got a Porsche and two BMWs in the front yard. And an old friend of his came by and said, "How in the world do you have all this money?" And he told him, "Well, I'm reading the Total Package, and their archives are like a diamond mine and all that kind of stuff." So his friend started reading us about a year ago, but he didn't know how to handle success, and immediately went out and got himself a couple of young girlfriends, whereupon his wife divorced him. He got fired. His children aren't allowed to see him anymore. His whole life went to crap.
It's all your fault.
And it's my fault, right?
One other thing I think people should know is that, you know, Clayton is, you know, when it comes to the biggest mailers in the world, Clayton is the AAA level copywriter, and there's only a handful of those people. Clayton is one of them, and a lot of the other ones are actually people that trained under Clayton or at least worked under Clayton, guys like Ben Savenga, right?
No.
Weren't you his copy chief at one point?
No. Well, I did hire him on one occasion, but Gary got his chops from Ogilvy and from Dan Rosenthal.
Oh, okay.
But Carlene Anglade Cole, Paris Lampropoulos, Kent Comey, Brad Peterson, and others.
Yeah, a lot of big names.
That I mentored, and Bob Hutchinson, are now earning over $1 million a year in royalties for the sales copy they're writing.
Yeah, and so these are the people that, like, Boardroom would call or an Agora would call, and, you know, when Phillips was around, that Phillips would call. And that says a lot about your skill, Clayton, that not only would they call you, but they would call people that were trained by you who have risen to the very, very top of the field.
Yeah, it's a kick for me to see them get ahead.
All right, so we dive into these questions?
Absolutely.
All right, cool. And why don't you know what? Before we even dive into the questions, we'll say it again at the end. But why don't you give people your URL so that they know where they can go to just get a lot more of you and always be able to stay in touch with you even after this call?
Sure, it's MakePeaceTotalPackage.com. That's MakePeaceTotalPackage, Total Package, all one word, .com. And
you have new blog posts every day there.
Yeah, we have over 400 articles in our archive on marketing, copywriting, web strategy, PPC, SEO, just every aspect of marketing. And it's absolutely free, the archive and the blog itself. So,
And you know, there's very few people that I go to for marketing advice. Clayton is one of them, and therefore everyone listening should make sure that they actually opt in and stay abreast of what Clayton's thinking and what he's doing and new insights and ways of doing things that maybe you haven't come across before. And so with that said, we've gotten lots of really good questions, and so we'll just dive in and do our best to get them all answered. So with that said, question number one, Clayton, is your headlines seem different, and actually that's kind of what I was talking about. They appear to be more emotionally driven than benefit driven. Why, and which do you think is better?
Okay, well, there are two reasons why I tend to go that direction.
And do you always go that direction or no?
Not always, no. But,
okay, so maybe you could also talk about, like, when you decide to go one way or the other.
Sure, yeah. The first reason that I tend to have a bias for emotionally driven headlines is that it makes my promotions very different from what everybody else is seeing out there. You know, we get something between 600 and 2,000 advertising messages a day, and the good ones, the horrible ones are entertainment as advertising, you know, bullfrogs croaking out Budweiser and chihuahuas eating tacos, but and those are the bad ones. The good ones, the ones that tend to work fairly well are the ones that offer a product benefit. And, of course, some of those that we all see all the time offer benefits that are unrealistic, not believable, not credible. And, Rich, a lot of what you write about in terms of attention deficit disorder on the web and elsewhere really ties into that, because we've been taught not to believe a lot of those claims. And so a long time ago, actually right at the beginning of my career, I was working in fundraising where you don't have a product to sell. You know, if you give $10 to a fundraising organization, all that really happens, you don't get hair on your head, you don't lose weight, you don't pick up more women, you know, you don't make more money. All that happens is you're $10 poorer, so they don't have a benefit to sell. So they became past masters. Even when I was getting started in 1971, they became past masters at recognizing the feelings, the strong resident emotions that people had about particular issues, and they were able to leverage those feelings into $100 million fundraising organizations. And so I actually got started running a folding machine for one of those companies, and, you know, till the wee hours of the morning when I was in college, and I had to read those, you know, I had the time to read all of those fundraising letters. And so, you know, I thought I'd give it a try, and that was really how I got started in copywriting. And the second reason ties in with the fact that, you know, the more emotional lead stands head and shoulders apart, really, and above, I think, the standard, you know, benefit lead. And that is that people don't buy for rational reasons. You know, if we did, there wouldn't be any Rolls Royces or Rolex or Porsches or 5,000 square foot houses or, you know, most investments, anything other than mutual funds. You know, if we were rational, we would save every penny that we earn for a rainy day, you know, so that we won't, you know, get hamstrung when things turn against us, or so that we'd have money to send our kids to school or retire one day. But instead, we buy all of this other stuff, and there's no rational reason for it. We have reasons. They're really excuses, and one of the things I like to say when, you know, we're selling products is to my copywriters, I ask them, give me the excuse our prospect is going to give his wife for making this purchase, okay? That's the benefit, okay?
Right. But
the real reason he's buying it is because it either fulfills an emotional desire, okay, or it assuages a fear that he has, or it will eliminate a frustration that he has. And so, you know, what I tell people is that if 99% of the purchases that we make are made for emotional reasons, you know, a great quote is, all you really need is a cave, a fire, and a piece of meat. Everything else that you buy is bought for some other reason than a rational reason. That may be a little bit of an overstatement, but, you know, it's basically true. The concept is true. And so I tell my people, I say, you know, if 99% of what we buy is bought for emotional reasons, then writing a headline or a promotion piece that focuses only on the rational reasons to buy is like going to a gunfight and leaving 99% of your bullets in the car.
All right. And so just so that people have a clear understanding, like an example of a emotionally driven or emotionally charged headline would be, like, one that comes to mind is one that you wrote for Weiss on the front of a magalog, like those lying, two-faced SOBs.
Right. Right.
Versus, like, read this and I'll, you know, you'll have a way of making lots of money in the stock market.
Yeah, there were two things happening there, actually, on that particular one. The first was that we had found that a lot of CEOs of top technology companies were going around the country doing dog and pony shows and showing investors why they should be buying their company's stock. And those same people behind the scenes were dumping their company stock like crazy. So there's a deep well of resentment against CEOs who are making $100 million a year in compensation anyway. And so, you know, we figured that, you know, that approach would really get people's attention. And we were able to name right on the cover some of the stocks that are the most widely held stocks in America, Microsoft and so forth. So the two things that were happening there was that tapping into a deep well of resentment against these fat cat CEOs who are getting paid huge dollars and producing lousy results for shareholders. The other one was that it was topical. This had to do with, it touched on news that the prospect was reading and therefore thinking about and therefore having feelings about. And so we were able to leverage that into a big winner for Wise.
Is there ever a time when you think a benefit-ridden headline is actually better than, like, that emotional style?
Well, I think in shorter copy, you know, if you're doing a fairly small print ad, for example, you may or may not have time to develop a theme that kind of overlays the benefits that you're offering. I think that, of course, online, the beauty of online is that no promotion stands alone. It's really playing out against the tableau of many emails and sales pages and events and other things that are happening online. So the texture and the concept, the strategy behind each piece of copy can be quite different, and you can have emails that bang on benefits and give your prospect the excuse he needs for it, you know, to give his wife, and then others that just really appeal to him on an emotional level. And I found, for example, that fireside chat emails, you know, done in very rudimentary Outlook format, you know, with courier type, are very effective in lowering the tone, you know, creating kind of an emotional texture in an email campaign, lowering the tone and bonding and being very credible and warm with your prospect, and then following that with something that's more exciting, more upbeat. You know, the key really, though, you know, I'm kind of getting into tone here, but the key really is to allow your message to dictate your tone. That way it never feels false. There's an old saw, you know, if you look out the window and your neighbor's roof is on fire and you go over to his house and you knock on the door and you wait for him to come to the door and you say, "Excuse me, sir, it appears that your roof is oxidating rather rapidly." You know, he's just going to look at you like you're crazy, right? But if you run over there and burst through the front door and scream, "Run like hell, your roof's on fire," you're going to get a very different reaction. And so, you know, the emotional texture is important, and keeping the emotion appropriate to the message you're delivering is also important.
Gotcha. And that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so then let's go to the next question, which is, what do you think is the best way to actually get good at writing copy, parentheses, versus knowing about it, after you've read all the courses and books out there?
Do it. Go out and get spanked. Learn your lesson. And do it again. Go out and get spanked again. And learn your lesson. And there's nothing that replaces real-life experience. And, you know, when you see somebody who's teaching copy and who's not doing it, You're looking at somebody who is, number one, not in touch with what's really working today and what has ceased to work today. And you're also not listening to somebody who is emotionally engaged with the success or failure of what he's doing today. So, you know, when I first got started, I had nothing but failures for the first year. And that first year was the year I learned more about copywriting than any other time of my life. So you got to get out there, do it, take your lumps, learn your lessons, and every single promotion will get better. It'll get easier to write, faster to write, and stronger in terms of response and conversions than the one before. But absolutely nothing can replace that experience.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, two things that have worked well for me, and I wonder if there's anything like this that you would recommend. One is actually taking a sales letter that I really liked, maybe in another completely different market, and trying to rewrite it for my product. You know, one that an A-level copywriter did do for a different one, and see if I can just change it so that it actually is now an ad for a product that I have. And the idea of just kind of like walking through it and trying to rephrase sentences that now are geared towards that product was very educational, at least, in trying to get that, like, you know, the pace, the tone, and the rhythm of copy. And then the other one that I've done is actually, and I don't know that this will be easy for people to do, but it is something that was very worthwhile and so might make a lot of sense for people to actually think about, is when I've written copy to then send it to somebody who knows a lot more than I do, ask them to change it, but when they change it to leave track changes on, like in a Word document, so when I get it back, I can see where I could have done it a lot better. And is there anything like that, Clayton, that
I think both that's really great advice. I don't think anything can possibly come close to the actual experience of doing it in the real world. But these two techniques are great. I'd also suggest that you show copy that you're writing to people who don't know anything at all about copy. Anybody who'll agree to look at it and tell you what they think, and to ask them to do the same thing, because in the end result, those are the kinds of people that you're going to be ultimately sending the copy to, right?
Right.
And Dan Rosenthal, who's one of the grand old men of our industry, and as I said earlier, was Gary Bensavenga's mentor. Dan's a buddy of mine. Does that all the time. He'll show it to. In fact, he would rather show his copy to people who don't know beans about copywriting, because he's going to get a visceral gut level, reaction to that copy from somebody who could very well be a prospect.
Right.
You know, I have a friend who writes a lot of health copy that just gets in his car, grabs his copy, gets in the car, and goes to an old folks home and reads the copy aloud to the people there, you know, and gauges their reaction. You know, he doesn't know anyone with arthritis or heart disease or heart failure or cancer or anything like that. So he just goes to a place where you find those people and he reads his copy to them.
And he knows he's got a winner when they say they'll buy it.
Yeah, well, and not only that, he identifies objections. He identifies the spots of the copy where they doze off. He identifies the spots of the copy where they appear to be skeptical. You know, it's something he swears by. It. This is Paris Lampropoulos. He swears by it. He says it works like gangbusters. I think Kent Comey has done it at least once, too.
Yeah, I'll have to try and scope out the old age homes around here. So let's move on to the next question, which is, it seems refund rates are increasing online, and actually, just a parenthetical statement, I just got back from Las Vegas yesterday, and that was something that came up in a couple of the discussions, that people are experiencing higher refund rates now than they did in the past. And so it's not just a quality of product thing. And so back to the question, how do I make a strong guarantee without losing money from returns? How can I give them a longer time to ask for a refund but not get burned?
Okay. I run into the guarantee question all the time. And, you know, clients that I work with for the first time tend to be people who are very chintzy with their refund policies. And some of them are that way because their accountants told them they had to be because of the type of accounting they do. Like, for example, in the newsletter industry, every new subscription is actually a liability because you have to fulfill it. So, that impacts refund policy to some degree. But some of them are just cheap, and they're afraid that people will, you know, a year from now demand a refund. We've tested it, and we've seen one of my clients, Martin Weiss, Weiss Research, this is several years ago now, but he had a 90-day guarantee on his $99 investment newsletter that we were selling. And you know, I asked to see the a graph showing month by month in a subscriber's lifetime when the cancellations and refund requests were happening. And surprise, surprise, we had this huge spike right at 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, why don't we do a heads-up test, an A-B test, a split, where we offer a one-year guarantee versus a 90-day guarantee, and then track it for a year, and track those people for a year. And we did that, and we found that the longer guarantee at the end of the year, our refund rates were like a tenth of what they were when we set the deadline sooner. And, you know, it's really intuitive. If I gave you a two-week guarantee on a product I sold you, everyone has a calendar on their refrigerator, and there'd be a big red circle around the date 2 weeks from now where you get to send the product back and get a refund.
Right.
And but if the refund date is farther out, then that's not going to happen. And I got to say, with at Rodale, and this was my idea, Rodale, but I certainly wrote many packages promoting their books and magazines that use this. Well, their books primarily that use this guarantee, but it was an heirloom guarantee. You know, even after you're dead, if your heirs decide this book isn't any good, just send it back. And not only that, here's the return label. You know, just cut it up, put it in your files, and if you or your heirs ever decide, ever, you know, until a comet hits Earth and wipes us all out, you can slap that label on the book, send it back to Rodale, and they'll give you a full refund. So,
is there anything, though, in particular, or is it just basically, you know, because there is this growing concern I hear from people, and it's actually, it must be accurate, that more people are refunding. Is it just basically, just look at it from a standpoint that those people probably wouldn't have bought, that the people that are doing that, are buying and then refunding, well, they wouldn't have bought if you didn't have it, so it's not really like money lost.
Well, I don't think it's money lost, but I think if you're seeing refund rates increase, there are several things that you can do. You can look at your messaging and to see if you overpromised or inadvertently created false expectations of the product.
Right.
You can look at the list that you went to, or the websites that you advertised on, or the affiliates that you worked with, and try to get a sense of why, you know, see where the refunds are coming from. Are they coming from your established customers, or are they coming more from one outside source than another? And you know, take a look at that source and see what the customer's experience is with the products that source is offering them. You know, there are a lot of things you can do post-mortem to kind of tear that apart and really analyze it. But I think over-promising and under-delivering is a big one. You know, I have my I did a power marketing summit a couple of years ago, and we sell the DVDs for $7,500 a copy. And, you know, we don't get refund requests. We just don't get them. But this guy writes to us, emails us, and says, look, fair is fair. You know, I bought this thing. I opened the package. I watched the videos. But frankly, they're not for me. They're a little too advanced. I need something more basic, and I just wanted to give you that input. I don't want a refund. So we refunded his $7,500 and then sent him an email saying, you know, I'm really sorry, and I refuse to keep your money. We've already refunded it, you know, and plus here's a discount coupon to buy anything else you want in our online store. We have other more basic products. Whereupon the guy sends me an email back and says, well, I've just gone to your shopping cart and rebought the videos because I'm not accepting the $7,500 sack. And we literally went back and forth like that several times until I finally had to call the guy and tell him, look, I'll make you a deal. Why don't we do this? We'll split the difference. And, you know, I've got a customer for life now with this guy. He's one of my biggest advocates on the web. And
yeah.
So, you know, that refund policy is absolutely, you know, crucial. But to look at how the people that you're acquiring, how they have been treated by the source company, the affiliate or the joint venture partner where you found them, I think is always worth doing.
Yeah, and I would agree. And I think that pretty much sums that question up. So let's move on to the next one, which I think is a really good question because I see really conflicting advice out there about this. It says, I've always heard don't use cliches. I've read in the total package to use cliches. What should I believe here? And then, and then based on that answer, if you want to give people some guidance as to when they should use it, when they shouldn't, I think that would probably be a good thing.
All right. Well, where to start? Okay, well, David Ogilvy made a huge point out. Now, David Ogilvy, direct marketing agency, Ogilvy Direct, which was run by my friend Drayton Bird, its claim to fame was really their marketing for Sears and for Rolls-Royce. And if you're known for marketing... If you're known for marketing Rolls-Royce, the manner in which you market the car is important. And Ogilvy is famous for saying that your ads need to speak to people in the vernacular that they're used to, that they use in their own daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
And David's example of that was a Burma Shave sign that got rejected that his agency suggested. And the sign, the series of signs on Burma Shave, you'd be driving down the road and the first part of a poem would show up and then another one,
right.
And it would all run. Well, this one was great. It said, carnation milk is the best in the land. Here I sit with a can in my hand. No tits to pull, no hay to pitch. You just punch a hole in the son of a bitch. And that's in Ogilvy's book. And his point is, if that's the way your market talks, you'll get more credibility, more attention, more readership by speaking to them in the way that they're most comfortable with. Now, how do we all talk? We all talk in cliches. Why? Because a cliche is like a word picture. It's worth 1,000 words. You know, if I tell you it's raining like cats and dogs, I don't have to tell you how many inches it's rained and how many hours or anything else. You just know I'm in the middle of a downpour, right?
Right.
So we speak in cliches, and that's for most of our markets, that's what we're comfortable with. So I reject out of hand the notion that cliches should not be used in sales copy. I think they're efficient. They communicate in a few words what would otherwise take a paragraph or more to communicate. They give your copy momentum. They give it color. They give it life. The only caution that I would give is know when enough is enough. You know, I have a client that loves to mix metaphors, drives me crazy. And the first thing in his opening copy, the stock market is a hurricane. And the next thing you know, it's a firestorm. And then the next thing you know, it's an earthquake. And, he's all over the place. That drives me crazy. And you can overdo the cliche thing. But I think cliches are like pictures. A good cliche in the right spot is worth 1,000 words.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And, I think that's really – I think the advice when people are talking about cliches and saying not to use it, it really is more accurately to say don't overuse them.
Right. Yeah. If you get to the point where the copy is just one cliche after another, a lot of what we do, you kind of have to feel your way through,
mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of a feeling you get as you're reading it. Oh, my God, another cliche and sometimes, too many of them actually confuse the message. So just kind of feel it through, but don't, rules are like pie crust made to be broken. That one definitely was made to be broken. And just think your way through it, feel your way through it.
And I think that's very good advice, Clayton. So let's go to the next one, which is, what's the first thing to test in one of my sales letters? And then it says, what's the best thing to test? So I guess we should start with the second part of that. What's the best things to test? And then what would you normally test first?
Well, the answer to both is the same. The headline, the second thing is the offer. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of the the headline, I've often seen, I mean routinely, seen a new headline lift response by 30%. And by response, I mean sales, okay, by 30%.
Right.
There's no other part of the copy that, unless your response device is totally screwed up, there's no other part of the copy that can produce that kind of multiple. The offer is more a strategy than it is the actual copy for the offer. But if your price is too high or too low, that can give you almost the same kind of multiple. So, you know, the rule is don't test whispers, test things that really matter. And the two things that really matter, and by the way, this whole Taguchi thing online has just gotten totally out of control. People are testing stuff that just doesn't matter, and their test results are quite often unreliable anyway for a lot of reasons. But if you test, you know, major and majors, the headline, which, and when I say headline, I mean headline, the eyebrow above the headline, the deck copy, and you know, if it affects how you should open your sales copy, also the first couple of paragraphs, your opening sales copy, that to me is a headline test, you know.
Right, and, your lead, basically.
Yeah, and so when I do it, when I do that kind of a test, like, you know, I do a direct mail piece. The client doesn't get a direct mail piece with one headline on it. He gets three or four headlines, and then we choose the two or three that we want to test, and we go out with three panels on our very first mailing. And then every remailing that we do, talking about direct mail here, every remailing we do, we have, you know, the control goes to, say, 90% of the list. Then we have a certain number of lists that are test lists that we hadn't tested before that we want to see how they're going to work, and that they get the control headline. And then there's always a panel of many thousand names where we can test two or three other headlines. And the reason for that, I mean, the beauty of it is that, you know, when you do a direct mail piece for an investment product, for example, you're going to be lucky if that promotion works for 3 months or 4 months before, you know, the response drops to the point where you can't mail it anymore.
Right.
But if every single time you're in the mail, you've got a headline test, and by the way, also a format test, you know, where you test a bookalog versus a 6x9 versus a magalog versus a tabloid or whatever, now you have this constant stream of self-renewing direct mail pieces, and you can extend the life of the guts of the copy to a year or two.
Gotcha. And what about, like, when is it, when should they go test headlines versus test, like, you know, change the offer? Is there any, do you have any guidance about that?
It varies widely from company to company. You know, a lot of companies, their offers are fairly set in stone, or at least can only vary within a fairly narrow margin. So you're going to find more opportunities to test headlines and offers. But to me, the price of a product, especially in the mail, is never set because the market constantly changes.
Right.
And, you know, I have a client now that we're just getting ready to begin working with, and they think they have an online product, and they think that the price, the ideal price point for their product is $4.95 per month. Now, they have a huge market, 138 million prospects worldwide.
Wow.
And so they're looking at, you know, a pretty nice monthly income from that lousy $5 a month. But I looked at it, and I couldn't see any rational reason why the product couldn't sell equally well, you know, at $29 or even $49 a month. And, you know, typically the higher the price, the, you know, there's a curve. The higher the price, the lower the response and vice versa. But we've tested price plenty of times and seen a higher price increase response, actually. And when it does that and increases average sale, I mean, what could be sweeter, right?
Right.
So, you know, that's a key to test, but it really does vary company to company.
Gotcha. Okay. And so then let's move on to the next question, which is, when I sit down to write, it's really hard. Has this ever happened to you? And if so, what do you do?
No, I have
to say. The story's my life.
Yeah, I know. I know. They were good. Was this your question?
My kindred spirit. That,
No, it's not hard for me. And, you know, I have a process that I use that could, I think, help people with this problem. And we outline it in one of our little reports called Beat the Blank Page Blues. But I can tell you what it is so you don't have to buy the report. Think about the process, okay? What do you have to do? Well, first of all, before I start writing, I have to research my product. And I have to determine what the key benefits are and what the key emotions are that are satisfied by this product, okay? And I have to start thinking about the order in which I want to present those things, my reasons why you buy. And so as I'm doing that, I'm essentially building an outline, right?
Right.
And so now I have the outline, and I know what I need to say first. I know each sales point that I want to make and the order I want to make them in. I know the proof elements that I need to include in order to establish and raise my credibility. And I know that I'm going to be presenting my offer at a certain point and my guarantee, my risk relief, my discount, my premiums. And so I have all of that laid out in the order in which I'm going to do it. Then it's a matter of dumping the actual information that fits in each of those buckets into that outline.
Right.
By the time
But you know what? Let me ask you another question that you don't have to answer until the end, but let me just throw it out at you. Like, this assumes that you already know the key emotional drivers of the marketplace.
Yeah, and, you know, we have some great articles on that in our archives. You know, how to crawl inside your prospect's skin is one of them. And, you know, but for most of us, I think, realistically, you know, if you talk to someone that graduated from Harvard Business School, he's going to tell you you got to do focus groups and you got to do polls and surveys and all kinds of other bullshit that doesn't ever work. But the fact of the matter is, Rich, you know, when you're selling a product, you know instinctively how your prospects are feeling. They know, you know what. You know, you have a real good idea what their experience is with other products like yours, other companies like yours, how they feel about the lack of the benefits that your product delivers in their life, how they feel about the prospect of having those benefits in their lives. You know, you already know those things. You know, if you had to sell a product on arthritis, you know that people who have arthritis are pissed off because they can't play with their grandkids and they feel guilty about that. You know, and they feel desperate that their lives are slipping away and they're not having this experience. You know, if you we call it the Stanislavski method. You know, it's like method acting.
Right.
If I was this person, you know, and I had arthritis, or I was this person who was trying to get a business off the ground and it just wasn't working, how would I feel? You know, and I think it's pretty easy to derive those. To figure out what those feelings are. Of course, another way to do it is to look at your competitors, what's working for them, and try to identify the emotional touch points in their promotions. You know, anyway, if that's an issue for you, look for that article.
How to crawl inside your prospect's skin?
Yeah, I think it'll really help.
All right, cool. Now back to this. So you just basically, you're following you have a structured approach, and you try and, like, line up your your key points in each of those before you even sit down to write?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I dump any research material that I have. You know, I need to know how much the Dow fell last month, or I need to know how much gold prices have risen, or I need to know the immunological effects of mushrooms on the human system, you know, whatever it is. And those are facts that have to be documented anyway in the copy, in my substantiation file, especially in regulated industries like health and or finance. And so, you know, I'm dumping those articles with attribution into my outline. Then when I sit down, I never have to write. I never have to face a blank page. You know, the material is there. And so I can just basically close my eyes, visualize myself talking to my prospect, and just let the copy flow out the end of my fingers.
So I wish it would flow out of my fingers.
I just have to think about if my best prospect was sitting in the room with me right now, what would I say?
Right.
What would I say to him? How would I address, you know, his resonant emotions, his desires, his fears, his frustrations? How would I start the conversation? What would I say next? You know, that's all you're doing. You're just having a conversation with somebody. You know.
I agree. Very good. All right. So next question is should I have a product before I write my ad, or can I write the ad before the product is done?
Okay, well, obviously you're talking about an information product here, something that you can craft, right?
Right.
Both ways work. Probably the ideal way is to write the ad first, because ultimately the ad isn't about the product. It's about the prospect. And so if you write an ad that touches on every one of his fears, frustrations, and desires, and fulfills them, you know, addresses them in every way that you can think of, you've just designed the ultimate product. So that's probably the best way to go. Having said that, in my life and career, I've almost never been presented with that opportunity. The one time I was, by the way, was you mentioned earlier that Wendy and I, my wife and I, started the entire health newsletter industry, and we really kind of did. The Phillips Publishing called me up and asked me to write a promotion for a new newsletter they were starting called Health and Healing, an alternative health newsletter, and it was a launch promotion for it. And it didn't exist.
Right.
There were no premiums. The newsletter didn't exist. So I jumped on a plane, flew out to Irvine, met with a doctor who was going to edit it. On the plane, I read a couple of things that he had written. I spent literally 1 hour with him talking, and then went back to my hotel and wrote the promotion. And in one afternoon, actually, the guts of it, and did a little fine-tuning when I got home. But that promotion and the two that followed mailed 90 million pieces. And
90 million pieces.
90 million pieces, yeah. Figure that royalty out, you know.
Yeah.
And
post office has got to love you.
Yeah. But, you know, not the tree huggers. We killed a lot of trees on that one.
Yeah.
But the point was, we were able to create the newsletter from scratch. And we were able to create the premiums from scratch. So we were able to position it. We were able to establish the doctor's identity and personality. We were able to do all of that. It was wonderful. But 90% of the time, I'm pretty much presented with a fait accompli when it comes to product.
Yeah, and I would imagine most of the times that's the way it is. But in general, for newsletters, you really do have the ability to kind of to craft you can always write a different promotion because, you know, before anything is happening, because you can kind of give birth to new premiums. And so often it seems like newsletter promotions at least, often are focused more on the premium than they are on the product.
Yeah, that's true. And there's a good reason for that, but I don't know if you want to go into it. But, yeah, most newsletter promotions really are selling the premium and not the actual product. Also, on many occasions, I've been able to go to the publisher and say, you know what, this product needs to be improved a little bit. Why don't you just add this box on page 3 of every issue so I can say X, Y, Z about it in the promotion? And probably half the time, you know, the publisher will say, hey, that's a great idea, let's do it. So you may have some input in that regard.
Gotcha. But it's never a bad idea to do that if you have the opportunity.
Right. Oh, no, it's a wonderful way to do it. Absolutely wonderful way to do it. You're essentially designing the product as you're writing a promotion.
Right. And, you know, in my experience is that the best sales letter I ever wrote you know, that made the most money was a project that I was doing with Jay Abraham, and it was actually, the product didn't exist yet, and so because I was such a loyal customer of Jay's before I was actually a partner, I got to write it from a standpoint of what would be the ideal product.
What would that, absolutely, you know, irresistible to me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's a great way to go. It's wonderful if you can do it.
I think this question is a little bit different, but than what we touched on earlier. But so maybe you can, you know, without talking about what you talked about before, just kind of maybe sandwich it with a little bit more of what the process is. And it's, can you walk me through your copywriting process from idea to finished sales letter? So you already talked about the actual writing of it. So maybe just spend a minute or two on both sides of it. From,
sure,
you know, what do you do before you even write that draft to after you've written the draft, then what?
Right. Well, we talked about research and outlining and all that kind
right.
of stuff. But essentially what I do is whenever I receive a start kit, you know, or a research package, I read it immediately.
Okay.
Even if the copy isn't due for 6 weeks or 8 weeks,
sure,
I'll read it immediately because I'm a big believer in this, in the Thomas Edison school of psycho-cybernetics, which is, you know, how your brain works, you really do more creative work when you're asleep than you do when you're awake. We all have an adult inside us and a child. The child is creative, and the adult is the one that is always telling the child to shut the hell up and sit down. And so the adult is our conscious brain, and the child is our subconscious. When the conscious brain goes to sleep, the subconscious is still working. It's making connections. And making connections is what creativity is. And so I believe that the more nights of sleep you get between the time that you input the data into your subconscious and the time that you have to output it in terms of copy, the better off you are. So I do that right away. And then the next thing I do is when I sit down to actually begin writing, like I said earlier, I literally will sit down, you know, lean my head back, close my eyes, put my fingers on the keyboard, and just start talking. And every single thought that comes into my mind goes onto the page. And I try to, if the adult stands up and says, wait, that's stupid, I just tell him to shut up and I keep writing. And I'm not looking to get even a draft at this point. I'm just looking to get every thought, every creative idea, every connection I can out onto the page in an order that makes sense. And then I go through a series of editing drafts. And in some cases, they can be quite painful and lengthy in terms of completely reorganizing the copy and so forth. But this is like where, this is where you get to face the Sophie's Choice. You know, which children you're going to off. Your copy is your children. So you're going through it and you're saying, you know what, this is a damn good argument, but it's not good enough to make the cut given the amount of space available or the amount of time that I have available to present this message. And so, you know, I as many drafts as it takes to get this thing to the point where it's just really great. And I have to say it's all over the ballpark depending on what kind of mood I'm in, what kind of product it is, you know, what else is going on in my life. I've done as many as 26 drafts on a direct mail piece that ultimately mailed 40 million pieces. So we invested $20 million in that package, right?
Right.
So it was worth 26 drafts, right? So,
right.
And then in other cases, I've been able to, like with the health and healing thing, it just flowed. Everything fit, everything worked, and, you know, I was done in like two or three drafts. So it just depends on you know, the assignment.
And
but
the importance of it.
The importance, where you are, how creative you are, whether or not the ideas are coming quickly, whether or not you have all the research you need available at your fingertips, you know, just a lot of things. But the thing is that, you know, I think it's important to allow your creative process to change project to project. Let the project tell you how it wants to get done. Rather than, you know, Paris Lampropoulos is very rigid and very left brain in how he approaches copy. Now, Paris is one of the top copywriters for Boardroom. He's a genius. He makes millions. He makes them, you know, tens of millions. But he's very rigid. The first thing he'll do is he'll sit down and he'll write 350 fascinations, bullets, you know, about the product. Okay? And he does that every single time.
Carly, 350.
350. It's got to be 350.
Yeah.
Don't ask me why. Then Carlene Anglade Cole, who's another one of my Cubs, former Cubs, who also makes millions writing copy today, she just, you give her a scrap of research, put her in a room, and her head explodes. She goes six different directions at once. She has thousands of creative ideas, most of them totally obscene and completely unusable. She just did a headline, "When you poop, do you dot, dot, dot." That was her headline on a promotion for a health product, a colon cleanse. But, you know, she's just totally right brain and nailing, and so her process is very different. I find my process varies from project to project, you know, just depending on what kind of product it is. And you need to give yourself that kind of freedom.